Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. So welcome to another episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast. Today we have a really, really awesome guest, Dr. Daniel King, who is faculty at Rosalind Franklin University in Chicago, and he is a very good friend of mine and a colleague. He's also very well known as a cannabis researcher in the nurse anesthesia profession and has given countless talks and published many, many articles on this topic.
Thanks so much, Rhea. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I know we've had many conversations about different aspects of cannabis pharmacology and implications for our patients. So I'm happy to share this conversation to a larger audience as well.
Awesome. Well, in this episode, we're going to discuss the uses and adverse effects of cannabis and do a deeper dive into the mechanisms of action, the molecular pharmacology, do some discussion on how to care for these patients, so somebody that is an acute user or a chronic user, and how residents and CRNAs can become involved in cannabis research if that's something that you're interested in. But before we go any further, Daniel, could you just give a simple definition as to what is cannabis? And what are the common chemicals that we find in this substance?
Yeah, for sure. So obviously it has a long history, right? It's been described by some as just a weed, but it really has a pretty long and interesting history that has established its therapeutic benefits and still modern day controversies. It has origins in Asia, where it's thought to have been discovered over 12,000 years ago and actually prevailed in the 20th century in America. But I'm not a botanist by any means, that will be the disclaimer, but the plant certainly has some interesting anatomical importance. Males, of course, are needed to pollinate, but females are most cultivated due to these large flowering colas at the top of them. This is where many different cannabinoids, terpenes, and flavonoids reside. Females have the pistils to take in the pollen and bud and flower, and the males actually have very few buds or flowers, but the sticky trichomes in that part of the plant that contains many cannabinoids we'll talk about today include things like tetrahydrocannabinol or THC and cannabidiol or CBD specifically. The plant itself is actually in a family called Cannabaceae. Now, this includes sativa, indica, and ruralis species that are thought to each appear a little bit differently and have different effects on people, but as these have been bred and hybridized over time, that is a little less applicable than it used to be historically. As a complete product, cannabis comprehensively contains over 500 chemicals, and over 100 of them are pharmacologically active cannabinoids.
Even as a pharmacologist, I did not know that kind of detail about this plant, and so many people use it, which is so interesting. How did you get into this field? Like, how did you get interested in becoming an expert in this topic?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess it's just through a natural spirit of inquiry, right? I mean, I got into anesthesia. I started working in various areas. And one area that I was working in particular, which was gastroenterology in the endoscopy suite, it seemed to me that a lot of my patients who were presenting for EGD or upper endoscopy were presenting with a recent history of cannabis use, and we were scoping them for nausea and vomiting related potentially to their cannabis use, but it wasn't well disclosed or it wasn't well determined, right? And so I got curious about this and wondered, what would be the effects on my anesthetic? What are the implications there? Are these patients at higher risk from a cardiovascular or respiratory standpoint? What are we doing about their nausea and vomiting? And so I actually at that time decided to conduct a retrospective study, which we published in ANA Journal in 2021, in which we didn't find any differences in those sort of things, the anesthetic agent requirements, the CV morbidity, mortality, patient satisfaction. But what I did find is only 7% of my patients were telling us that they were using cannabis, whereas I had state prevalent data to tell me it should be more like 20%. So then that opened the next box, right? Like, how are we actually identifying these patients? Are they going unidentified? And then what sort of effect does that have on our anesthetic management of them?
Huh, that is interesting. I actually never knew that that's how you got into it, but you're right. When I'm in GI also, a lot of the patients, you say upper endoscopy, but I see the whole gamut of GI system problems with chronic cannabis use. And when I tell people that, you know, there's a lot of these GI problems that can be linked with cannabis, a lot of people don't want to believe it, that their symptoms could be related to the chronic use. Because you always think about respiratory, right?
Yeah, these are hard conversations to have, both with patients and with healthcare providers. And stigmatization is still a major barrier to having those conversations. From that study I was just telling you about, we conducted a national exploratory survey, which is published in the Harm Reduction Journal this year, which we found that most cannabis-using patients are actually the ones initiating the conversation about this, if they have the conversation at all. About 15% of the time, it's the healthcare provider. So as I continue to work in the space to educate healthcare providers and explore the science, it just continues to evolve. And I learned that there is so much potential to learn about how it's used, its implication, and why it is being used among patients amid an increasing prevalence.
Yeah, absolutely. You talked a little bit about the current statistics of use. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what the statistics looks like in the United States for use, especially in some of those younger users as well, and how that could potentially lead to developing substance use disorder?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, this is a really pivotal point in time because according to a Gallup poll that was conducted last year, for the first time in modern history, more patients are using cannabis or smoking cannabis than smoking tobacco. So think about all that you learned in nursing school and in your anesthesia program about the implications of tobacco smoking and cessation and all these things. And now benchmark that and compare it to how much you learned about cannabis. I, for one, learned very little about cannabis in my formal training and educational programs, and we're just now starting to really integrate that into our curriculum. But it's estimated somewhere around 20%, 22% of Americans have used cannabis within the past year. That's 60 million people. And in our younger age groups, it's even more prevalent. We think probably one in every five people age 12 to 20 have used that in the past year. And in our youth, this is a population that's vulnerable. They're more vulnerable to develop substance use disorder amid different psychiatric and psychological problems for which they may be self-medicating. And so it's really important that we're initiating these conversations very early on and we're able to guide them appropriately to healthcare resources.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, I think, a very under-researched group as well. A very high, one in five, you know, youth between 12 and 20, and then very little research done in this group as well. Let's dive into what people use cannabis for and maybe some more of those adverse effects that we're going to see with cannabis use.
Yeah, so in that study, that national exploratory survey that I was telling you about, we found that most people are using it for pain or anxiety, and that's pretty consistent with prior studies that have been conducted. Some study, it tends to alternate one and two, who's using it for pain, chronic pain control especially, but also anxiety. We also see increasing trends related to the use for sleep disorders. And in our veteran population with PTSD and nightmares and things like this, they're able to get to sleep sooner and stay asleep longer with the use of cannabis with a little bit of THC in it. There are dozens of different uses for it, though, whether it's for recreation, there's use in prevention and treatment of seizure disorders, immunosuppression and tineoplastic properties, and appetite modulation and its antiemetic properties also give its usefulness in our oncology population. And we see it being used in the treatment of glaucoma for decreasing intraocular pressures due to its ability to decrease the amount of circulating aqueous humor in the eye. There are actually about, depending on the state, 57-ish on average different qualifying conditions for the medical prescribing of its use, which includes things like seizure disorders. Epidiolex is one drug that is approved by the FDA, which is cannabidiol that's useful in the treatment of seizure disorders. So it's possible, yes, your patients are using it for recreational use, but it's also possible they're using it to treat a medical condition that you need to know about in the perioperative period.
I actually worked with a scrub tech who had a daughter who was nonverbal, and part of her poor development, and I think at this point she was probably 9 years old, 9 or 10 years old, nonverbal, primarily because of this continuous seizing. I mean, each day she would seize probably 50 times each day. So she just never had an opportunity to develop properly. Tried every single anti-epileptic medication that was out there, all the tests, all the doctors, all the specialists, nothing could control her. And because of her age category, she couldn't qualify for medical marijuana. So he actually got the marijuana illegally to give to her, and she was able to stop seizing, get off of all of her medications, and finally start being able to speak. And, you know, that's just an anecdote from just watching how his life transformed because of the medical use of this. And I think that the legislation and the research still needs to catch up to what these families are experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's such a telling story because, you know, cannabis remains in Schedule 1 by the FDA, yet the FDA has approved an oral preparation of cannabidiol for the treatment of complex seizure disorders like this. So it is hard to get it, and it is effective in its treatment, and that's very frustrating for many patients, families, and healthcare providers.
Absolutely. Well, what kind of adverse effects could we see from a use of either within its, you know, quote unquote, normal dosages or in higher or chronic use? What would you see with that?
Absolutely. So, you know, I want to first and foremost say there are many therapeutic uses for cannabis, no doubt. But in anesthesia, we tend to, we're in the business of mitigating risk, right? And we're in the business of preventing and mitigating and treating it when it occurs. So there are certainly adverse effects that we should know about. Those tend to be worse with the inhalational routes, which have obvious respiratory consequences. We are the airway experts in the business of also managing the airway, but it's also worse in increasing concentrations of THC. We find that those products that are richer in CBD tend to have more medicinal value. We do worry about those high concentrations of THC leading to neurological issues like psychosis. We worry about the smoking route, particularly causing myocardial ischemia, and that THC can lead to tachycardia and hypertension, which is going to further increase myocardial demand. With the smoking route, there's a principal triad of events that occurs, like decreasing oxygen supply in the setting of increased carboxyhemoglobin, and even increased platelet aggregation that can presuppose myocardial risk. Respiratory-wise, obviously, if you're smoking it, we're worried about all of the same things we worry about with tobacco smoking. And there has not yet been a formal link established to lung cancer, but I wouldn't be surprised to see that very soon because the histology staining patterns under a microscope are very, very similar. And in fact, they are occurring earlier in chronic cannabis smokers. In the gastrointestinal system, we worry about things like delayed gastric emptying by about 30 minutes to 2 hours more than usual. And chronic high-dose use can lead to a hyperemesis syndrome, which brings us back to that gastroenterology suite that I was telling you about earlier.
Interesting. I've also seen and read studies about, especially in younger users too. So that's always something that we need to look out for in our patients as well. I think sometimes as anesthesia providers, we really like to kind of stay out of that realm. Mm-hmm. And I think when it comes to decreasing stigma and really giving comprehensive care to patients, I think we really are an important part of that team where we can check in on patients as they're coming in from surgery and seeing how things are going for them and finding the right providers to take care of them after surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. And just being informed, right? And being informed about the products that you're using. Since the 1990s, the average concentration of THC in these products has gone up 10%. So they can be using really high dose THC and they may not even know that because it's such a poorly regulated industry and labeling tends to be inaccurate for these products. So we can be informed ourselves. That will lead us to be able to better inform our patient.
Now, taking a deeper dive into the chemicals, that, and you mentioned there are hundreds of chemicals that are within this plant. Some of them we know quite well, right? We've heard of THC, we've heard of CBD. Some of us don't always understand kind of the mechanism of action, the receptors that they're hitting, what those receptors do in our body normally, and maybe what the endogenous cannabinoids are in our body, meaning the cannabinoids that our body makes naturally. And maybe a lot of people out there didn't know that our body made cannabinoids, but yeah, very much that is part of our own physiology. Can you speak a little bit more about just the molecular pharmacology and the mechanism of action?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is certainly your wheelhouse, Rhea. You and I have talked about this, and I've been more reliant on your knowledge than my own with this. But I will tell you that a lot of people don't know about the endogenous cannabinoid system. But we do know a lot about something somewhat similar by mechanism when we talk about endorphins and we talk about achieving runner's high or, you know, being in a state of euphoria with the administration of opioids. And it's kind of a similar mechanism when we talk about what's endogenous in our body and what's exogenous that we're giving to the patient to try to replicate that for other means or reasons. But before we begin to understand the effects of these exogenous or phytocannabinoids or synthetic cannabinoid products on the human body, we have to also understand that there's an intrinsic system in place and naturally occurring processes within each of every one of us right now. Everyone who's listening to this podcast has an endocannabinoid system. And this was discovered not so long ago. It's 30 years ago, but in medical science, that's not too long ago.
The knowledge growth since then has been huge.
In the recent time that I've been studying this, it's just continued to expand. But it's such a complex biological system. It influences and maintains homeostasis for every single organ in the body. It modulates motor control, emotionality. Everybody's system is somehow influenced by the ECS, and it has a complex system of receptors or binding sites for naturally produced ligands that target them. The components of cannabis are also going to target those same receptor sites to produce very similar types of responses.
Yeah, from what we know, there are two primary receptors. So there's the CB1 and the CB2. And the primary ligands for these receptors are AEA and 2AG. I'm not going to pronounce the entire chemical names for that, but AEA or 2AG are the primary endogenous ligands for this endocannabinoid system. And like Dr. King stated, it's very similar to the endorphin, your natural endorphin system, especially when it comes to pain pathway. These receptors are involved in modulating pain, so attenuating or decreasing the type of pain signals and nociception that goes to your brain. So now we have this endogenous system. Now we're giving, or, you know, people are taking this exogenous chemical that is very similar in structure to what your body is producing.
Yeah, definitely. So we have those two major ligands. So these are naturally produced ligands in your body. And in fact, Dr. Ethan Russo has termed a condition called clinical endocannabinoid deficiency, in which he thinks similarly as to how someone may be deficient in serotonin and that could cause depression. An endocannabinoid deficiency could lead to chronic conditions as well. And maybe cannabinoid supplementation is necessary, like you would prescribe an SSRI potentially for that patient. Those two ligands you mentioned, AEA and AG, are 2-arachidonylglycerol, have certain origins in their discovery as well. So that AEA or anandamide really comes from the Sanskrit word meaning bliss. So this is what is alternatively known as the bliss molecule. So that's naturally occurring within us, but we get or maybe utilize THC as the exogenous form, which is the main psychoactive component in cannabis, which also shares affinity for the CB1 receptor. 2-arachidonylglycerol or 2AG is really the second major endocannabinoid or endogenous ligand or neurotransmitter. You can use all those sort of interchangeably, that was discovered. And it has effect by binding to CB1 and CB2 as some primary target receptors for cannabinoids. So think about how those receptor mechanisms work. And if you want to think of it as a lock and key, all the sorts of things that they unlock, it's really, really fascinating pharmacology.
Mm-hmm. I know that, you know, THC directly stimulates the CB1 and CB2 receptors. The CBD, we're still a little bit unsure as to the exact mechanism of action. Some believe that CBD doesn't directly stimulate the receptors, but actually prevents the metabolism of the breakdown of your endogenous ligands, the AEA or 2AG. Do you know any more about the mechanism of action of CBD?
Yeah, you're exactly right. So when it comes to those major cannabinoids, THC and CBD, we have much more clarity about what goes on with THC. CBD is a little more gray. We think that it's probably working as a negative allosteric modulator at CB1 receptors. So it can work to attenuate the euphoria and the paranoia, those things that are more so associated with THC. And you'll find that these cannabis products typically have varying ratios or combinations of THC and CBD to achieve the effects by their, but they also work synergistically with other cannabinoids that they are present with. So having a CBD isolate versus a broader full spectrum product in the presence of other cannabinoids can influence the entourage effect, if you will. And this is where I really emphasize with providers that not all cannabis products are created equally. So you can't just think that because my patient uses cannabis, these are the effects on the body. It really can vary depending on whether they use more CBD predominant or more THC predominant products, because those two main cannabinoids exert different effects within the endocannabinoid system.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I think this ties back to the point that you made earlier, which is there are people that have varying levels of endogenous cannabinoids that they're going to produce. If you have an exogenous molecule that comes in and maybe the mechanism of action is to alter your own system and your own system is hypofunctional, then people complain that, oh, whatever product doesn't work for me, or, you know, and not really understanding that kind of some of it depends on your own personal pharmacology too. And I think this is where getting more into that precision medicine, getting into that pharmacogenetics is kind of the future of pharmacology and how we kind of like customize medicine for people. So maybe a topic for another podcast. So awesome. Thanks for taking a dive with pharmacology. So let's move on to people that are users. You have people that can come in with acute use or toxicity, or you have people that come in that are chronic users, or both chronic users that are acutely intoxicated. I know this is a large topic and in itself could take another hour, but maybe we can talk about it briefly, just ways to kind of approach these types of patients and how to deliver the best care to them.
Yeah, totally. This requires a real careful approach because a lot of providers have inherent bias that they don't realize. I mentioned the stigmatization and the destigmatization component earlier. What I have found correlated most strongly with not only overall stigma, but a subcomponent of that, which is anticipated stigma, that is likely to lead to non-disclosure, your patient not telling you about their cannabis use. It's really based on the persistent worry that if I share my cannabis use with my healthcare provider, they're somehow going to treat me differently as a result. The care that I'm going to receive is going to be somehow inferior. Being able to alleviate the concerns, because what we also found is comfort level with the healthcare provider was the highest rated characteristic that would lead to disclosure. So the more that you can drive that comfort level with your patient and be very objective in your approach, the more likely you are going to be able to get that information from them, which is actually pretty critical to be able to provide informed care, because you can't take care of what you don't know about. There are also finally some formal recommendations in clinical practice now for and guidelines for how we should manage these patients. And they include screening all patients. And that's a grade A level evidence. And that includes the type, the amount, the frequency, the time, the route of last consumption. And that's for every patient. It should be objective.
Now, I know a lot of our learners are going to say or ask, What's an example of a way that you would actually have this conversation? Or what is an example of when you take care of these patients or you see them in the pre-op holding area? What is a simple way that you can start off this conversation so that you show that you are not judging them, you're unbiased, you just need the information?
Well, that is a research question in and of itself. The development of the QBAT, or the Cannabis Use Behaviors and Assessment Tool, out of Northeastern University with Dr. Lynn Reed, myself, and Nadia Slotkey as the lead, Dr. Nadia Slotkey now as the lead investigator on that, but really involves just being objective. It's very simple. The first question you ask is, have you used cannabis in any form within the last month? You need to specifically ask about cannabis or you might not get an accurate intake. A lot of providers will ask about smoking or drug use, and depending on the nature of that, the patient may not actually respond to that. Additionally, there's negative connotations that can be injected into that, right? So I've heard providers say, you don't smoke anything, do you? Or you don't use any drugs like marijuana, do you? And specifically mentioning cannabis too, because cannabis is more inclusive. Marijuana actually has a negative historic pretext to it. And so specifically asking about cannabis and being objective and being succinct about that, non-judgmental in your approach is really, really important.
Mm. I think that a lot of people don't even realize that they're saying that because they don't even realize the bias that they have against it. And that's so interesting that you mentioned it like that, to say, you don't do this, do you?
Right.
You know? And so I think that it really, for somebody who's already hesitant to tell their provider, they would just go along with it, you know? So you talk about screening patients. What else do you do during this time period?
Yeah. So as we're kind of formulating evidence-based recommendations for how to manage this in the perioperative setting, a lot of evidence is pointing to the fact that we need to educate our patients. That means we need to be educated ourselves in order to do that, inform risks and implications, but also share with the patient what you plan to do about that, how you plan to manage their pain or their risk for nausea or things like that that are associated with cannabis. Adverse effects related to smoking. We should be prepared to delay elective procedures for recent smoking history by 2 hours. And we know that is because there's increased risk for myocardial ischemia. The risk is increasing doses of available THC within the first 60 minutes of last use. But also we need to neurologically evaluate our patients for psychosis and determine whether or not we can obtain informed consent, right? And you may prepare your anesthetic differently as well.
What is the mechanism behind the MI risk? Is that a vasospasm type mechanism?
Yeah, it's multifactorial, and it's not just for patients with underlying coronary disease or coronary risk. This can happen in young, otherwise healthy patients. It's based on increased myocardial demand, primarily from increased circulating catecholamines that result once you smoke that THC. The odds ratio goes up much higher in that first 60 minutes of use, but there's increased circulating carboxyhemoglobin, actually increased platelet aggregation. At the same time, you have a propensity for increased surgical bleeding as well. So it's kind of a consumptive sort of coagulopathy, if you think about it, and then increased myocardial oxygen demand. So it's multifactorial, but yes.
I'm just imagining me and you or somebody explaining to a surgeon why we need to delay the surgery for an hour or two and going through this whole mechanism, and for them to just be like, what's oxygen?
It is that vital molecule for human life. But you know, what's great is we now have actual formal guidelines that have been published to back up. Yeah. On this. So it's not just your opinion. It's actually evidence-based and it's long overdue. Yeah.
Nice. Love that. So what about you started to talk about anesthetic requirements, anesthetic agents. How does that play into this?
Yeah. So here's the problem. It's way more prevalent than we have research evidence to guide our decision-making. And so we're trying to catch up. And because it's been Schedule I for so long, there's federal restrictions research that have prevented our... But we think there are increased anesthetic agent requirements, potentially and especially with high THC concentrations and with propofol use because of a shared CP450 pathway. We can't definitively say that for CBD yet because we don't exactly know how CBD is metabolized. So again, you can't have a patient who uses cannabis and just assume that their propofol requirements or the anesthetic agent requirements are going to be 2 times higher. Theoretically, it makes sense. We need the science to really demonstrate this, to say this conclusively. The patients, otherwise, aside from just maintaining your anesthetic, caring for their pain can be challenging. We know that there is potentially a hyperalgesia mechanism that occurs through the TRPV1 receptor. Our patients in some studies demonstrate up to 2 times the amount of opioid requirements if they use cannabis in that immediate postoperative period. Once they go home, though, they actually have decreased opioid consumption and decreased opioid dependency rates that develop when compared to the average population. So a lot of work to do in that area. And there's also consideration that our patients have increased risk for post-op nausea and vomiting as well.
Yeah, this is actually a study that Dr. King and I are starting to embark on, which is looking at, you know, this post-operative hyperalgesia that's occurring. People have observed it. They know that this is happening. And this is acute use. This is not chronic users. But we don't really know. You know, nobody's really strongly looked at this. And so this is what we're going to embark on by starting with, you know, systematic review and then eventually going on to some prospective studies. So I'm excited for that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you can draw a lot of conclusions, but until you have the research evidence to definitively say that, it's hard to know. My presumption is that once the patients get out of the hospital and they go home, they resume their cannabis use, right? And they probably have pain control, but we have inconclusive evidence to really establish a cannabis at this time with sufficient evidence as an acute pain therapy, even though it's used for chronic pain management. So it's really conflicting and it's really hard to parse out, and there's so much work to do in this area.
Absolutely. And, you know, one area of research that's also very, very understudied are some of our special populations. So we talked a little bit about the youth and the peds population earlier, but there's another population that is also really understudied, especially when it comes to substance use and substance use disorder, and that's the obstetric population. Already a complicated. Now, what are some of the things that are out there surrounding obstetrics and cannabis use?
Yeah, good point. So there's things that we know cannabis works for, and then that can also work against us later, like pain control. But also in the obstetric population, we see increasing use related to nausea and vomiting during that peripartum period. And we know that this is based on how cannabis works. It's concerning because we know there's placental and breast milk transfer. So there have been reported adverse effects on fetal development, early fetal delivery, and low fetal birth weight. And we know that it does transfer in the breast milk. So organizations like ACOG have come out and advised against cannabis use while pregnant and while breastfeeding for those reasons. I talked to you a little bit about the consumptive coagulopathy and the bleeding risk. And so you might be inferring, oh, can I do an epidural? Can I do a spinal in this patient population? Absolutely. We've determined that Neuraxial is still safe in this patient population, but there's a lot that goes into this and there's a lot of education that needs to happen in the obstetric population.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, there is a university that I have interviewed with recently for a faculty position. You know, and trying to find other researchers out there that are substance use disorder researchers and pain researchers. And they actually just started a center for like maternal fetal care of people that have substance use disorder. So it's out there, but it's still kind of a small and slowly growing field. So something to look out for. So speaking of research, there are lots of residents out there and lots of CRNAs that are interested in cannabis research. But of course, the question is always, how do I get started? What are some recommendations or advice for people that are maybe thinking about going down this career road and potentially becoming your collaborator one day?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll jump in because we have a lot of work to do. Since it's been a Schedule I drug, that's been a really difficult research barrier. It's hard to get these studies through an IRB. There's only specific laboratories in the United States where you can study this. We can only source cannabis for research through one place, which Dr. Peter Greenspoon has called the cannabis that you get from there moldy mush, because it doesn't even replicate what you can get in the dispensary down the street, right? So we really need, the first thing we need is to support efforts to deschedule cannabis from Schedule I. President Biden in 2022 called for marijuana reform, in which he requested the Attorney General to really expeditiously review this. And then in September of last year, the Department of Health and Human Services recommended a move to Schedule III. So there's some progress and some pitfalls with that, but it should make it a little bit easier for us to research it. So with that in mind, go find a mentor. Contact CRNA authors who have published studies on this. There are many great authors. There are nurses who have devoted their whole professional interest into cannabis care. The American Cannabis Nurses Association is one of them. I'm a member of the ACNA, and I encourage you to pursue that as well. They have a student rate, and there's lots of great information for free and lots of great people to network with. The American Nurses Association is another great one. They recognize cannabis nursing as a specialty in 2023, and there's probably going to be a certification coming forth as well that you can earn in cannabis nursing. There's a growing number of formal educational programs for cannabis study. There's one out of Maryland in which you can pursue graduate studies in medical cannabis, but there are others throughout the United States as well. If you're wondering, what should I study or what topics should I be pursuing while I'm pursuing these educational interests? We need more research surrounding the destigmatization approaches, specifically focused on that anticipated stigma component. And we really need good prospective studies to correlate anesthetic agent requirements, morbidity, and mortality based on the chemotype or the cannabinoid profiles that our patients are consuming. Again, they're not all created equally. So what are the implications for the high CBD user versus the high THC user? I really would also like to see some studies that evaluate postoperative outcomes as well, like postoperative cannabis withdrawal syndrome, implementing the cannabis withdrawal scale. We use the CWA scale in alcohol withdrawal. We don't actually have implementation of a cannabis withdrawal scale. The hyperalgesia component, the postoperative nausea, vomiting component, there are so many things that need to be studied. The opportunity just abounds, which is why I've been so driven to study this field and make an impact.
You had mentioned finding a mentor. I want to swing back around to that topic. Of course, we want to stay within our field and say, let's find a CRNA mentor. I will say that a lot of us CRNA researchers didn't always have CRNA mentors to start, because CRNAs becoming researchers is still kind of a relatively new thing. You know, there aren't as many out there as there are maybe a nurse practitioner mentor, or maybe a non-nurse mentor that is an expert in the field, knows research very well, and is willing to take you on and teach you what you need to know, and then you can be a trailblazer. So just keep that in mind when you're finding mentorship. When I started research 17 years ago, most of my mentors were nurse practitioners. So
it's so interesting you say that, Rhea, because a mentor that I found, Dr. Carrie Cadu, actually published the Cannabis Nursing Handbook, and she's a PhD in nursing, and she's not an anesthesia provider, but she's really guided me throughout this process as well. And you're right. So, you know, look for those interdisciplinary folks and people that stretch beyond the field. Take a risk. I just took a risk and just contacted the author that was listed on a book that I was really interested in, and it grew to be something really fruitful.
Mm-hmm. I've taken risks too, where I've gone to conferences where I knew there was somebody there that I was really interested in, and I've either stalked their poster sessions or I've stopped. So there was one lab that I was interested in, and I found out that his postdoctorate researcher was presenting a poster at this conference. So I actually became friends with him. I just networked my way to this person that I wanted to meet. Sometimes that's just what you have to do. It's all
absolutely
all part of, you know, just be learning about the field, finding mentors, finding colleagues, and getting your foot in the door. Sometimes it's not a straightforward, obvious path. You know, a lot of us got here because we kind of zigzagged our way to the places that we're at now. So awesome. I think that was a lot of really amazing information. I know that the residents and the learners and the faculty and CRNAs are going to get a lot out of this episode. There's kind of like one, I'm kind of curious what your one thing about cannabis research or the field in general that just gets you so super excited and just makes you the most passionate. And what is something that you kind of like a final takeaway that you just like really love about the field?
Well, I would say knowledge is powerful, and the ability to care for a patient is such a privilege, and to provide informed care to that patient is the most impactful. The more that I can learn about this, the better the difference I can make in those patients' lives. And it doesn't have to be for cannabis. It can be for any condition. I just feel that we have a great potential based on the knowledge gaps that exist here to make a profound impact in the lives of many, many patients.
Absolutely. Well, that is it for this episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast. Thank you so much, Daniel King, for coming on this episode. We had a great time chatting with you. And if people want to get in touch with you, what is the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Sure. Yeah, we can put a link, my contact information and the details with the podcast, but you can contact me at daniel.king@rosalindfranklin.edu.
Awesome. Thank you so much.